Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. It's November 9th, 2020, live to be rebroadcast November 11th, 2020 on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host, Ron Maniza. During the pandemic, we are not broadcasting in the UConn Student Union. Instead, we are broadcasting live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut, on Mondays at 10 o'clock a.m. on Facebook Live. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. So, pretty historic weekend, huh?
Yo, you think so?
Right. So I was busy. I was at the NHAND conference, the New Hampshire Association of Naturopathic Doctors conference, which I love to go to every year. And I went there. And where did I go? Well, as you can see, I'm looking at you on Facebook Live. And that is my tablet that I'm using to talk to you. And that is where the conference was. And I'm reading to you from my other tablet, my iPad. And it was there too. So what was very funny is because I had this great app, I could go anywhere, and I wound up leaving the house because I had some errands to run, and I was able to listen to the conference on Friday and Saturday on my phone and not miss a beat because I was able, it was portable. I could take it anywhere. So that was great. And I learned a lot at the NHAND conference, and I'll probably do some more summaries of the things that I learned at the conference. So I was sitting minding my own business, listening to the conference and on my computers and devices. And it was such a gorgeous day. We've had this beautiful several days of weather where it's gotten up into the 70s and it's going to do that again today. So I was sitting outside and I got a text from my friend who was one of the moderators of the conference. And he texted me that Biden was stated the president-elect, that he was stated the winner, and Kamala Harris, of course, the vice president-elect as well. So my understanding of this is he was called president-elect on Saturday, and that the media does that, but the Electoral College doesn't actually vote until December 13th. Is that how that works?
Yeah, something like that. It's 2 weeks after the election, I think, is roughly what
when
it
they
is.
Definitely yeah. Submit them, and I think there's going to be some attempted lawsuits to change electors or question the validity of the votes. But I think the overall sense is that this is it. That Joe Biden is the president-elect and Kamala Harris is the vice president-elect. Whatever side of the fence you're on, it is historic because it is our first woman vice president. You know, the first time that a woman has been elected to one of the highest offices in the land. And she also happens to be a person of color. So it's very exciting. I mean, she's one step from the presidency. And Joe Biden selected her because he thought he needed somebody who could take the office of the presidency if he became unable to do so. So he was being realistic. And so it's very exciting in that sense. And, you know, we need to, and there are people who are feeling jubilation. There are people who are very happy about what happened. And there are also people who are very disappointed and even angry. And so we need to be respectful. It's not a good idea to gloat and, you know, and throw the fact that your candidate won in someone else's face who might be disappointed. And then realize that there's a lot of, no matter what happens, there's a lot of work to be done in any direction. And so, so if you're celebrating, that's great. And if you are not celebrating, my heart goes out to you. And however it is, we are all Americans. We are all part of this process. And I hope that there can be a path to us all coming back together, because it's my feeling that we are all more similar than we are different. So a couple of neat tidbits before I get into what I prepared for the talk today. One is that there is a vaccine that has been come out. One of the companies has come out with a vaccine that's purported to be 90% effective. When exactly that will be available, I'm not certain. And it'll probably go to people who are high risk first. When will it be available for wide distribution? That's hard to say. But one of the companies has come out with a vaccination that's supposed to be a high rate of effectiveness. So I'll see if I can get more details on that and report back to you. The other thing that's interesting is that one of the things I learned at the conference, I learned a lot of things at the conference this weekend, and that's really, really great. But one of the tidbits that I learned is that the CDC has made a statement about how the coronavirus is really spread and how COVID-19 is really spread. So this is something that can be very useful information to you. How you tend to get it, it is thought that the main mode of transmission is through aerosols, and you need to be within 6 feet of somebody who is infected for at least 15 minutes. So if you are close to somebody for a minute who is infected, you are unlikely to catch the coronavirus because you have to get enough of a viral load for your immune system to kick in and start fighting it. If you have too low of a viral load, you're going to have immune antibodies that are just going and immune cells that are just going to fight it off, and you're not going to get any sort of infection, and you're not even going to get any sort of detectable infection. So that's the issue. So if you were in face-to-face contact with somebody who was infected for more than 15 minutes, then you're considered to be exposed and you have a much higher likelihood of infection, especially if you are unmasked. So what that's saying is if you are masked and you are in the presence of somebody even who's unmasked or masked who's infected, you're unlikely to catch this virus. That's why most people don't have the virus. If you look at the state of Connecticut, we have currently, what, a 3% infectivity rate?
Mm-hmm.
It's higher than it was, but it is only 3%, which means that 97% of cases of people tested don't have it. So it's also likely that if you start to feel cold or flu symptoms, you probably don't have COVID. I'm seeing patients who are worried because they have cold and flu-like symptoms, and I've had some people come down with things, and most of them don't have COVID. I've had, so far in my actual practice, I've only had three people out of, the hundreds of people that I see who are COVID positive. That's 3%.
So I have a question for you.
Or less. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. So if I am masked, let's give a scenario here. If I'm masked and I protected myself, and I am with someone who is unmasked and has the virus, and can I get it any other way?
If you're masked, how
susceptible am I to getting it with someone who is infected?
So you're saying if you're masked and they're unmasked?
That's correct.
I think it's possible for you to get it.
I have that situation at work. That's why I'm asking
right.
you.
That's right. Well, I would stay away from those people. Well, I would keep your mask on.
I can't.
And so the thing about that is you're at work because even though you're not spending 15 minutes with any one person.
No, I'm not.
Say everybody who came through. Yeah. Because you're in a stall and you have people who are in cars as you go through at your
Correct.
Job. So you have people. So say that every single person who came through was infected,
mm-hmm.
And you had to interact with them, and you're also taking their credit cards.
That's correct.
So if that's going on, one could posit that you could accumulate 15 minutes of exposure. Every single person would have to be infected. I would say that your likelihood of getting infected is very low. And Gary, hi Gary, says that they really have to sneeze on you. And he has a point.
Yeah.
So you okay. have to remember, and or cough too, he's right. If they're in the car, and the thing is they're not 6 feet away from you either, are they now?
No.
No. So you have to be breathing in their aerosols. The other thing is you're in this booth and they're outside. They're technically outside. And between the two of you, you have an open window. You have the world and then you have your booth. So it's not like you're indoors. Right. So even if they sneezed or cough, their stuff is going to disperse.
Right. But if they sneeze or cough into their hand and then touch their credit card and hand it to me,
I would use the hand sanitizer.
I use it all the time.
So fomites are right. Fomites, that's catching the virus from touching something and then touching your face. It's not thought to be as much of a vector as aerosols. Aerosols are really the number one way that you catch this virus. And then droplets, which is from a sneeze or a cough. So droplets are actually a little bit harder to catch the virus because droplets will go into the air. And especially if they sneeze or cough in their car, the droplets are really kind of unlikely to get on you. And you're wearing a mask. So so the other piece is, of course, if they're handing you their credit cards, you should be sanitizing after every credit card touch,
right.
Like after every single one.
Right.
And so you're going to greatly diminish the possibility that you're going to get this fomite contact.
Okay.
So this is the reason to sanitize. If you touch something and you're concerned that it has COVID on it, you sanitize your hands. That's why every time you come out from a store and you get into your cars, you use your hand sanitizer. Every time you get out from your car and get into the house, go in and wash your hands with soap and water. It's better to use soap and water than it is to use hand sanitizer. But hand sanitizer is still helpful. So you use hand sanitizer when you can, or use soap and water when you can, and use hand sanitizer when you don't have it. And you can have hand sanitizer everywhere. And so then you greatly diminish the likelihood that you're going to catch the virus from fomites. But the deal is you have to be in the presence of somebody for at least 15 minutes who's infected and breathing their aerosols. If you are wearing a mask, you greatly diminish the amount of virus that can get into your system. And we also know that how sick you get with this is based on the dose of virus that you get. So it's a really good idea, of course, to not put yourself in situations where you're going to be in at least 15 minutes of contact with people within 6 feet of people who you don't know what their status is, or certainly if you do know what their status is. So, in my practice, I'm feeling pretty confident, as I said, because both of us are in my practice life. When I'm consulting, we're 6 feet apart, we're both masked, and I have a HEPA filter running, and then I do a lot of sanitizing after they're gone, and I have hand sanitizer at my workstation, and have hand sanitizer on my desk, so I'm sanitizing a lot, and so if I have to touch the patient, I'm using sanitizer in between every touch. So that's what the CDC says it's about aerosols, and that's what we understand. So wearing masks, even if you are around somebody who has the virus, will reduce the amount of virus that you get. And so the best thing is to not put yourself in situations where you're going to be in less than 6 feet of somebody for more than 15 minutes. So you're unlikely to catch it if you go to a store, especially if you get in and out. And, when you're in the store, social distance. When you're in the checkout, you're not social distance from the cashier. Cashier usually has a plexiglass between you and them. So you're unlikely to catch it from them. And you're both masked anyway. And you're not usually going to be in contact with that person for 15 minutes. That's unusual. And when you're in line, you're social distancing. So going into a store is a pretty low risk activity, unless you're in a store and it's extremely crowded. And around here, that doesn't happen so much. It can happen, of course. If you live in a more populous area, it could happen. So the big thing is, if you're going to shop, know what you're going to buy, get in and out of the store. And if you're in and out of the store in less than 15 minutes, you're good. And then my advice to you is, as soon as you get out of the store, wash your hands. And as naturopaths, we're encouraging you to clean your nose with nasal spray. It can be saline. It can be saline with xylitol and grapefruit seed extract. It can be a mixed essential oil nasal spray, which those are things you can get at health food stores. You can get them online. You can get stuff with oregano in it. You can get nasal sprays with tea tree oil and thymol and menthol, which are all great antimicrobials. And so, you might want to keep that, if you're concerned, you might want to keep that in your car. So as soon as you get out of the store, you blow your nose and you do your nasal spray. And if you want to get an herbal throat spray, you can keep that in your car too. And herbal throat sprays can have great ingredients like echinacea, propolis, berberines, and astragalus. And you spray that in your throat when you get out of a store, and you're also less likely to catch it. One of the other things that we learned at the conference this weekend is about elderberry. We had two views of elderberry. We had one, Heather Zwicky, the infectious disease specialist, said to us that there is no evidence that any herb causes a cytokine storm. And that was one of the reasons that it was concerned that elderberry can give you a cytokine storm because of the way it stimulates the immune system. But there's no cases or evidence that that happens. It's just theoretically based on the way that the herb works. Alan Gaby, however, he didn't entirely agree with that. He said that because there's some concern because of its mechanism, and he's just as concerned with the mechanism of action as he is with the whether there are actual studies in clinical studies on how the herb works. And he said, in early stages, you're not likely to have that cytokine storm. So, and elderberry has been shown to be effective. It's not shown to be effective against COVID-19, but it has been shown to be effective against many viruses because of its general mechanism of action. So it is something useful. I'm taking it for prevention. You take a small amount for prevention, and then he's suggesting take it early in the illness, and as you're convalescing in the illness, or you get partway through the illness, then you stop taking it. That's and then you take other things that you're not as concerned that they're going to cause a cytokine storm. So that was an interesting piece. And so I'm going to organize my thoughts and get together, and I'll talk to you more about some of the other tidbits that I learned at the conference. There were more than tidbits. There was a lot of information. There's always a lot of information when you go to a conference, and after a while you get overwhelmed. And even though the conference was virtual, I still felt overwhelmed after a while. Then there's pros and cons to going to a conference virtually. The pro, like I said, is that I could take my device in my car and go run an errand and still be listening to the conference. And so I did that. There were things that I needed to get done, and I did that. And I also was switching the conference to different devices depending what I was doing. It's nicer to watch the conference on a tablet because you can see the chart notes. So I would have the slide notes. So I would have the conference running on one tablet. I would have the slide notes on another tablet. Because if you just watch the conference itself, the speaker would be scrolling the slide notes at a rate that didn't work for me, and I might want to go back and forth. So I had them running because we had a proceedings book virtual on, so I was running that on another tablet, and then I had a computer going so I could take notes. And then I had my phone so I could text with my friends.
Aren't you supposed to be working?
So one of the things, usually when you're at the conference, you have your friends around you that you'd like to see, and you see them once a year. Hopefully I'll see them more than once a year. And this time my friend David was one of the moderators of the conference. And so my friend David Olarsh, he was up in Maine. I'm not sure if he was relaxing or just hanging out. But he was in Maine and he was moderating the conference, and I don't think anybody was in, there was no central location. Everybody was giving their talks from their homes, and everybody was participating from their homes or their offices. That's what you had. I mean, Dr. Mercasey was out in Arizona, and Todd Bourne was out in Washington State, and the moderators of the conference were in their respective offices or homes in New Hampshire. It was pretty cool. So the nice thing about it was that you could sit anywhere you wanted. You could get up and walk around and get something to eat. You weren't overeating conference food, and you weren't, forced to sit still in one spot and, brushing past people in the conference. And, And so that part of it was nice. And if you got warm out and you could change your clothes, there was all kinds of stuff that way. You could go to the bathroom whenever you wanted in your own bathroom. And so that was a good side. The unfortunate side was simply that, you know, when you go to a conference, one of the things you do is you network and you talk to people and you gather with people. And that was the unfortunate thing, that you didn't get to do that. There were some opportunities to do virtual meetup rooms, and I did say hello to people virtually, but unfortunately I didn't get to see people. All right, so that's some interesting stuff going on. We've got the a few tidbits about the CDC's recommendation on how the, or his pronouncement on how COVID-19 is spread, and we've got some interesting stuff on elderberry. And so one of the things that happened is, while I was sitting outside participating in the conference, I got a text from my friend David, who was moderating the conference, and it said that Biden had been pronounced the winner of the presidential election. So that was very exciting. And as I said, we need to be sensitive to people who this was not what they wanted, and not gloat, not have Schadenfreude. But, you know, be happy and excited that we have the first female vice president and the first person of color female vice president, that she is a person of color. It's very exciting. And this means a lot to a lot of people. And there are people who have been marginalized in the last 4 years who are really breathing a sigh of relief. I don't want to alienate anybody who is unhappy with the results, so I'm going to keep my comments brief on this. It's for a lot of us, it's exciting. For others of us, it's very disappointing, and they're hoping for this to somehow be overturned. I don't know how likely that is. I think it's pretty unlikely. Do you think it's pretty unlikely? Yeah.
Very unlikely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you think that?
Because I don't know that there's enough basis for any of the lawsuits. Right. And that's really what's being investigated right now. You can't bring it to the Supreme Court until the lower courts approve the basis for the lawsuit.
Right.
So yeah, there's a process that you have to go through in order to get it there. And all the lower courts are saying that there's no substance to the claim. If they had strong evidence of things happening, you know, of votes being stolen or somehow altered in some way, then they could do it. But there's no strong evidence at this time that I have seen. Okay. But that's my opinion.
All right. So that's what we're thinking right now. So now I'm going to talk about 11/11. So Gary, I hope you're still listening, because happy birthday in 2 days. And
happy birthday, Gary.
Yeah, because it's if you are listening on Wednesday, happy birthday, Gary. And it is November 11th. It's the day of the armistice. For people who follow such things, 11/11 has spiritual significance. Those who notice it may be more open to spiritual awareness. That's what's thought about 11/11. Intriguingly, the 11th day of the 11th month marks some powerful events in contemporary history. The armistice that ended the fighting in Western Europe during the First World War took effect at 11 a.m. Paris time on November 11th, 1918, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. Remembrance Day, honored in all parts of the Commonwealth, which meaning the British Commonwealth, is the tradition of observing 1 minute of silence at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. Data reveals an increase in the number of marriages that took place around the world on the 11th day in the 11th month in 2011. Global God's Day is celebrated on the 11th day of the 11th month. So why are so many of us aware of the phenomena? On a metaphysical basis, the appearance of these numbers is said to occur more frequently with those who've opened themselves to spiritual guidance and self-discovery. Many relate experience a feeling of being lovingly pushed to establish a conscious connection with the higher self and the universal God energy or universal spiritual energy, depending on what your relationship is with spirit or with, you know, your spiritual practice. Whether this awareness is engendered with the paradigms of traditional religion or gained through walking in alternative paths is inconsequential, as the phenomenon is manifesting globally. That's what some say. What is meaningful is that this is seen by many as an indicator of an increasingly powerful call to consciousness that is occurring all over our beloved planet. The depth of the 11-11 connection would appear to be synchronized to our level of awareness and understanding of how fundamental the connection that exists between the physical and spiritual worlds. So there are people who get excited when they see 11-11 on their watch, when it's November 11th, or it's 11-11 on November 11th, that people get excited about that. And they, it's thought of as a greater call to spiritual awareness. And I wanted to shout it out because although I'm recording this on November 9th, you may be listening to this on November 11th. And so, you know, my dear friend Gary's, you know, it's his birthday too. So, and he has an interesting sort of awareness of a lot of stuff. He's certainly somebody in my life who has introduced me to a lot of interesting things, including some spiritual stuff. Gary is a person I'm thankful that was in my life, and it's his birthday. So happy birthday, Gary. Anyway, the next thing I want to talk about, I actually want to talk about a topic that I've been interested in and I've been seeing more of lately, that women are coming in with this problem. And so this is a nice thing where we'll hashtag it and we'll have people, hopefully you'll tell your friends that to listen to this. So I want to talk about dysfunctional uterine bleeding. So dysfunctional uterine bleeding is more common than you might think. There's a lot of women who are listening to this. If you're postmenopausal, you're going, oh yeah, I had that. And others of you are listening, oh my goodness, I have that. And what do I do about it? It's because I've been getting more women coming in lately with this condition. So I thought I would talk about it. So what is it? It's when your menses are heavier than normal, when for more than a day you're changing tampons or pads or hourly or more, when your flow is so heavy that you're passing many clots, especially if they are large, and when they pass, they can be painful as well. When you have excessive pain or cramping, when your periods make it so that you can't go to work, be there for your family, or otherwise participate in your life. So there can be causes of dysfunctional uterine bleeding, and dysfunctional uterine bleeding is also, it's kind of like irritable bowel syndrome. You will get labeled with a diagnosis of dysfunctional uterine bleeding if they can't figure out a specific cause for it. But there can be some coexisting conditions. One of them is endometriosis. Another is adenomyosis, uterine fibroids, uterine polyps. And so let me explain what those are. So endometriosis is it's a painful condition. It's where, so the endometrium is the lining of the inside of your uterus, and endometriosis is a strange condition where you get uterine lining growing outside of the uterus. So it can grow on the reproductive organs. So it can grow on your cervix. It can grow on your fallopian tubes. It can grow on your ovaries. It can also grow on your bowel, and it can grow on your omentum, the covering of your fluid and fascia covering of all of your organs. It's just a connective tissue covering that keeps your organs in place in your abdomen. So endometrial rests, you know, bits of endometrial tissue can land anywhere inside your pelvic cavity. The problem with that is that they're hormone sensitive, and when you get your menses, they develop endometrial lining. It's not really lining because they're not inside the uterus, but they develop an endometrium. And then when your progesterone decreases and goes away at the time of menses, they bleed. And when they bleed into your abdominal cavity, it's extremely painful. It causes inflammation. Your abdominal cavity doesn't like having blood in it, and it sees it as an inflammatory condition and mounts an inflammatory response. So it's extremely painful. Then there's adenomyosis. Adenomyosis is when the glandular tissue of the uterus breaks through the mucosal lining of the uterine wall and is exposed to the outside of the uterine. The lumen of the uterus. It's exposed, and so when you have that glandular tissue, that can also cause excessive bleeding. Uterine fibroids are when you get benign tumors of the uterus, and the uterine fibroids can grow deep in the muscle tissue. It can grow in the middle of the muscle tissue, and then they can grow right onto the endometrium as well. And they're benign tumors that are hormone sensitive, And especially when you're getting older and you have less estrogen, they can't be maintained as well by your hormones, so they start to degenerate, and so you can get a lot of bleeding then. Uterine polyps can also bleed, and you can get just an excess of tissue, and uterine polyps can form because of friction. They can also form because of low-grade infections, and they're just bits of tissue that grow out from the uterine lining, and they can cause blockages. And so if you can't have your uterine flow the way that you're supposed to, you can get clots. And the uterine lining, uterine polyps can partially detach and they can bleed too. Hormonal abnormalities like thyroid problems or elevated prolactin hormone. You can have elevated prolactin because you have, not when you're nursing, but prolactin is the hormone that causes you to produce milk. And you can have a benign tumor on your pituitary gland that makes prolactin. And so that'll make it so you have an overgrowth of uterine tissue. And then when the uterine tissue finally is able to come out, you'll bleed a lot. Medications like anticoagulants, aspirin and other NSAIDs, anything that makes your blood thinner can make you bleed a lot. Sometimes excessive exercise or weight loss can cause excessive uterine bleeding, and sometimes it can do the opposite. It'll shut down your periods. Obesity can enhance your when you're overweight, you're more likely to have more body fat, and body fat produces estrogen, so you can have a thicker uterine lining, so you can bleed a lot from that. Stress or illness can cause you to have more uterine bleeding. It can also shut down your periods, but it can cause you to have more uterine bleeding simply because stress makes it so that you have less progesterone, so your uterine lining doesn't have as much integrity, and you're more likely to bleed. When you start menstruating in adolescence, you may not have regular ovulatory cycles, and your progesterone may not be lined up yet enough to have you produce a uterine lining with a lot of integrity, so you can get excessive bleeding.
Okay. You're good.
So when you're at the end of menstruation, in your menopausal years, again, your progesterone is the first hormone that tends to go down. And when you don't have as much progesterone, your uterine lining, once again, won't have as much integrity. So one of the things that can happen is women in their perimenopausal years will have excessive uterine bleeding. And it's hormonal. Now, if you are postmenopausal and you start bleeding, this is an emergency. You need to get assessed for possible uterine cancer. So if you have stopped your period for more than a year and you start bleeding again, you need to go directly to your gynecologist and have an endometrial biopsy, because you need to be tested to see if you have uterine cancer. Now, mind you, you can bleed and have it not be uterine cancer. You can have bleed. You can see bleeding on your panties or a pad. And it can be something else. You can have prolapse and you can have irritation. You can have a uterine prolapse where the uterus is coming down through the vaginal canal and it's rubbing against your panties, or it's rubbing against you when you're walking, and it can get irritated and it can bleed. So you can have things like that. You can have bleeding that you think is coming from your vagina, but it's actually coming from your urethra. And you can get prolapse of your urethra too, especially in menopausal years. So there are some conditions that way that are benign that can be helped where you will see some bleeding. But you need to get that assessed because you need to have endometrial cancer ruled out. So how do you treat dysfunctional uterine bleeding? Well, that all depends on the cause. So MDs will usually offer chemical hormones such as oral contraceptives or a Provera shot, or you can even get Implanon or Explanon, which is it's contraceptive that are tubes that are implanted into your arm. That's another way that they're treated. But usually you're given oral contraceptives. And so why would you be given oral contraceptives? Because when you get a chemical contraceptive, especially oral contraceptives, usually they have a synthetic estrogen and a synthetic progesterone. They are not natural estrogen. They are not natural progesterone. And they can't be, because if they were natural, then they would continue your cycle. But what you're doing when you do chemical contraception is you're trying to shut the cycle down. So the synthetic estrogen that is generally used, I don't know if another synthetic estrogen is ever used, but the synthetic estrogen that's generally in oral contraceptives is ethinyl estradiol. And the synthetic progesterone or progestin that's usually used, that varies. And I think there are a bunch of them simply because different pharmaceutical companies got rights to different progestin. So there's desogestrel, there's levonorgestrel, there's norethindrone, and Yasmin and Yaz have drospirenone. So there are different ones, and depending on the drug you get, it's going to have different progestins. And so what happens is when you have chemical contraception, you're not going to have a normal cycle, you're not going to ovulate, so you're not going to have much growth of the uterine lining. And progestin doesn't produce a thick, healthy uterine lining like progesterone does. So your uterine lining tends to be small and thin, and the ethinyl estradiol blocks natural estrogen. So estradiol is going to cause growth of that uterine lining. So your oral contraceptives tend to stop the cycle. So obviously oral contraceptives are not, oral contraceptives are not you're not treating the cause. You're treating, you're basically giving substitute hormones. So, because you're not treating whatever is initially causing the hormonal change. You're simply giving a drug that is blocking the effects of that hormonal change. And it can take away your dysfunctional uterine bleeding, but it can have other side effects. People have side effects from oral contraceptives. And one of the things you have to realize is that oral contraceptives you have a greater risk of cardiovascular disease, especially blood clots, because you have a synthetic estrogen and a synthetic progestin. Synthetic progestins do not afford you the protections that natural progesterone does. Natural progesterone can protect you from increased inflammation. It can protect you from blood clots, and it can reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease and also reduce your risk of reproductive cancer. And progestins do not do that. So you are an increased risk of blood clots, cardiovascular disease, and reproductive cancer. They can raise your blood pressure as well. And a lot of women report to me when they're taking chemical contraception that they feel more irritable. They're not as happy and they don't feel as good. And they also have a reduction in sex drive, which that always seemed crazy to me, that you take this drug that's going to prevent you from conceiving during sex so you can have sex without worrying about getting pregnant, makes you not want to have sex.
Yeah, that makes no sense. That doesn't make any sense at all.
But that's how it works, because when you block estrogen and progesterone, the other thing that happens when you take oral contraceptives is you have an increase in a hormone called sex hormone binding, or a protein called sex hormone binding globulin, because your body does recognize the synthetic hormones enough so that it recognizes the synthetic hormones enough so that it will make the sex hormone binding globulin, which then goes ahead and binds up your androgens, which help your sex drive. So it binds your testosterone, and now you have a reduced sex drive, which is unfortunate. So you don't get pregnant, but then you don't necessarily want to have sex, which is unfortunate. How do you get assessed? Between your gynecologist and your friendly local naturopathic physician, ideally you would have a pelvic ultrasound over the abdomen and also intravaginally to get a good view of your uterus and ovaries, and you'd also have an endometrial biopsy. An endometrial biopsy is where they take a pipette and they insert it into the cervical canal so that they can get some endometrial tissue. And then the endometrial tissue is looked at and it's sent to a lab, or usually it's sent to a lab. And the lab and trained technicians will look and assess the endometrial tissue to see if there are abnormal cells. And then you would get a diagnosis. So in naturopathic medicine, we have specific treatments for uterine fibroids, adenomyosis, endometriosis, polycystic ovaries, and supportive therapies for cancer. If those have been ruled out and there's no apparent reason for your dysfunctional bleeding, we treat by optimizing hormonal balance and reducing blood flow. So all of those conditions can cause dysfunctional uterine bleeding, but dysfunctional uterine bleeding can be a diagnosis by itself, and that's what I'm referring to today. Because a lot of women come in and they don't have uterine fibroids, they don't have adenomyosis. Some of them have not been assessed for adenomyosis or uterine fibroids, or they come in and they're bleeding a lot and they've just been given chemical contraception, but they haven't been further assessed. And I usually think it's a good idea because I want to know what's going on. If you have adenomyosis, I need to know that. If you have endometriosis, I need to know that. If you have polycystic ovaries, I need to know that because the treatments are somewhat different depending on what you're treating. However, one of the speakers that at our conference was Marian Marchese, who was a student of Walter Crinian, may he rest in peace. He was a great naturopathic expert in detoxification and environmental medicine. So one of the things that we see that you have to look into with all of these conditions is, does your patient have environmental exposures? And they usually do. And you assess them for things like, if you can, you assess them for things like heavy metal exposure. And you can pretty much assume that someone with dysfunctional uterine bleeding has exposure to xenoestrogens, estrogens that are not in our bodies, that are compounds that come from the environment that stimulate estrogen receptors. So you're going to find those. Unfortunately, you can find those in cosmetics. Parabens, for example, you should check all of your cosmetics, any cosmetics, lotions, salves, creams, and shampoo for parabens. And if they have parabens, don't ever buy them again. Because parabens are endocrine disruptors. The other thing that can be a problem is that there are, unfortunately, dioxins in the environment, and those are bleaching agents for paper, and dioxins are endocrine disruptors as well. You can also sometimes get hormones from feedlot animals if you're eating them. And so those animals can have excess hormones in them. Sometimes they're given hormones. So you have to be careful about that. And so anyway, in naturopathic medicine, we want to rule out any of these conditions. If you have a specific condition, then we're going to treat you for that specific condition. So if we rule that out and you simply have dysfunctional uterine bleeding, you don't have adenomyosis, fibroids, or endometriosis, then we're going to help you by optimizing your hormone balance and helping to reduce your blood flow. So some of the herbs that we give are directly to reduce blood flow. And so ginger, yarrow, shepherd's purse, cranesbill, and life root are all herbs that directly can reduce blood flow. And so when I'm treating my patients, I will give them a combination of these herbs and they really can be helpful in slowing things down. These are not necessarily hormonal disruptors, but they actually act on the blood vessels to slow them down. Vitamin A, we give high-dose vitamin A and also vitamin K1. High-dose vitamin A can help to slow excessive menstrual flow. And we tend to give those vitamin K1 as part of the clotting cascade. So if you give extra vitamin K1, that can help to slow things down too. We use a lot of homeopathy. Homeopathy is, some people are not as excited about homeopathy. I'm very excited about homeopathy. I think it's very helpful. And you give the homeopathic remedy that fits the condition that the person has. And so homeopathic remedies, when you give them, you have to give the remedy based on the actual situation that the person is having. So homeopathic Sabina, I tend to give that out more than any other for dysfunctional uterine bleeding. A homeopathic Sabina, some of you women can relate to this, when you'll have a lot of heavy bleeding with big clots, and when you pass the clots, they're painful. You'll have a lot of cramping. And this is the most classic situation. You have a lot of bleeding, you have a lot of clotting, and the reason you get those big clots is because when you're bleeding a lot, your body will respond by trying to stop the bleeding, so you make clots. And when you're having a lot of rapid blood flow, your body responds by making clots. And so the next thing that happens is now you have this big solid object inside your uterus. And whenever you have a solid object in your uterus, whether it's a clot or a baby or a tumor, your uterus has pressure receptors that respond to that. So you start to get spasms in your uterus because your uterus is trying to expel whatever it is. And that's one of the reasons you get so much pain. So clotting, the bigger the clots are, the more pain you're going to tend to have. So homeopathic Sabina, you give that when there's a lot of bleeding, you're making a lot of clots, you have a lot of cramping, and you have pain that's extending down your legs, and it's a bad situation. Veratrumalbum, you'll give that, so some of you can relate to this, unfortunately, when you get a really bad period where you're having a lot of cramping, a lot of pain, you may be having a lot of bleeding, you may get nauseated and vomit, and you feel, you get into a cold sweat. That's so when you see that picture, and I had that happen to me once, and I have a friend who that happened to her a lot, and women will come in with that symptom picture, and so I'll give them veratrumalbum. Erigeron and Secale. What's interesting is Erigeron and Secale are both two ergot derivatives, and ergot derivatives can slow bleeding. Secale is just homeopathic rye, or ergot, which is a ergot is a mold that grows on grains, and Erigeron is made from the mold. And so both of those can slow down bleeding. You don't tend to have as dramatic symptoms with Erigeron and Secale, that you'll have passive bleeding where a lot of blood is coming out. There won't be as many clots. There won't be as much pain. You give Ustilago, which is another ergot derivative. Ustilago is given when the person has uterine fibroids. And yarrow, or millefolium as it's called in homeopathy, you'll give that. That's just a general bleeding remedy. And usually you're going to have a lot of fresh blood where you're bleeding a lot and it's hard to stop bleeding. And you don't necessarily have clots or not. But that's another one we try. We also will give yarrow as a tincture. We'll give it just the actual yarrow herb in tea or tincture. So the other thing that you want to do is liver detoxification. You want to make sure that the liver is working healthfully. And so we will tend to give liver herbs so you can metabolize your hormones better. And so you can metabolize out xenoestrogens and xenohormones. So that word xeno means foreign. So it's a xenoestrogen is a hormone. It's a compound that comes from something else that has a structure that's similar to estrogen and will bond to your estrogen receptors. So why is that a problem? It's because when you have those compounds hitting your estrogen receptors regularly, you can get overgrowth of tissue in your uterine lining, and you'll get more overgrowth than you would if you didn't have those present. So if you can cycle through your hormones better, you're going to have less likely to have an excess uterine lining. The other thing that happens is if you're having overstimulation of your estrogen receptors, you're going to wind up with a situation where you're estrogen dominant. And when you're estrogen dominant, again, you'll have too much of your own estrogen. You won't have enough progesterone to offset it. You'll have this combination of your own estrogen for a couple reasons. One is that you have more chemicals going through your body, so your body can't metabolize your own estrogen as readily because your liver is besotted. It's bogged down with all these extra hormones, with your own hormones as well as toxins from the environment. And so you want the liver to be working well so the bile can move through freely. And so you can excrete your excess estrogen. And that's one reason why people with people who exercise a lot will tend to get lighter periods, because they don't make as heavy a uterine lining. But exercise is something that can really be helpful in reducing your, if you have estrogen dominance, it can reduce your estrogen sensitivity, simply because when you're exercising, you are running your blood through your liver and your kidneys so many more times because your heart is beating at a higher rate. You're perfusing all of your muscles and you're perfusing everywhere in your body. So anywhere where there's extra estrogen, that's going to be picked up and it's going to be pushed through your organs of detoxification. And then you're going to do some sweating and you're going to wind up drinking more water after you sweat. And that's going to make your organs of detoxification work more efficiently. And if your blood circulates through your body so many more times, it's going to, any volume of blood is going to see the liver and the kidneys many more times. And so you get more detoxification. So exercise itself is a treatment for any kind of hormonal condition, especially dysfunctional uterine bleeding, but any kind of hormonal condition, exercise will help. And so if you stimulate the function of the liver, you can do that with herbs like milk thistle, with colagogue amino acids like choline and inositol. Artichoke and turmeric are also herbs that help stimulate the liver. So is dandelion root, chelidonium. There's many herbs that are liver tonics. But the big ones that you hear about are milk thistle, artichoke, turmeric, and dandelion root. Those are easy to find, and they're often often in liver combinations. So your digestive health. If you are constipated, this can aggravate your dysfunctional uterine bleeding. If you're constipated, and I have people come in and they're telling me about a condition and they don't bother to tell me that they're constipated. So fortunately, I look through their intake form and I check their digestive function, and it asks how many times a week do you have a bowel movement? And they'll have checked off once or twice a week. And I'll go, you have a bowel movement once or twice a week? And I'm thinking to myself, why didn't they tell me this? Because some people think that's normal.
That's not normal.
I've had people say to me, you're supposed to go every day?
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So people don't know that you're supposed to go every day. And one of the reasons they don't know is because their physicians don't tell them. And I don't know if physicians don't think about it or they don't ask them, but it seems like if you're not having a bowel movement every day. Now, if somebody's going on alternate days and they're happy and healthy and they have no problems, I'm okay with that. But it's hard. But that's not who I see. I see people with problems. So if they come in and one of the things that's going on is they're having a bowel movement 1 to 2 times a week, I'm going to help them go to the bathroom.
Sounds like a no-brainer to me.
So we treat your constipation. We help you. We can help you with high-dose magnesium or whatever dose of magnesium gets you going, chia or flax seeds. Just generally increased fiber in your diet, and you usually talk to the person, and they're not eating as much vegetable and fruit as you would like them to be eating. And another tidbit that we learned this week is that if somebody has diverticulosis, diverticulosis can be, as long as you don't have another reason why you can't eat these foods, if you eat an apple and or a pear and or some prunes every day, that can really help prevent you from getting diverticulitis, even if you have diverticulosis. You're just eating a lot of fiber, and the fiber that's in those apples and pears and prunes helps you to be more regular. So you throw some apples and pears and prunes in your diet along with other fruits and vegetables and increase your water intake. Get your exercise. If you exercise, will help you to be more regular. If you're eating food intolerances that slow you down, whatever they are, too much sugar, dairy, whatever it is, try to stay off those food intolerances. You want to be having a healthy bowel movement every single day, and one that's easy to pass and doesn't give you gas and bloating, and also you're not having diarrhea, that you want to have a decent form stool every day. Probiotics and fermented foods. And if you're not a fan of fermented foods, you don't have to pound a whole bowl of sauerkraut, but you can take a few mouthfuls of it. You can have it like I do. It drives me crazy. I have kombucha in the fridge that I sip off of, because I'm not the person who was going to drink a whole bottle of kombucha at a sitting, but I will have a few sips of it until I finish the bottle, which may take me a few days. That works for me. And probiotics, there's a couple of things about probiotics. Probiotics will help you. There's a couple ways they make you more regular. One is that they produce organic acids that stimulate your colon so that you have more regular colon contractions. And the other thing is if you have good bacteria on board, they outcompete the bad bacteria, the anaerobic bacteria, that will cleave the hydroxyl group that makes your hormones that you're excreting in your stool more water soluble, and then you wind up reabsorbing them. So probiotics help to prevent that effect. We help people with their thyroids. And one of the ways you help people with their thyroids, and you have to remember this, is that if you have heavy metal toxicity, heavy metal toxicity can affect your thyroid. So you help the person with their thyroid, and you might want to backtrack and see if they're heavy metal toxic. Yes, I know. And if you are hypothyroid, one of the effects is to have disordered menses. So you check somebody's thyroid function and see what's going on there. If you are hypothyroid, if it's extreme, we might suggest you get a prescription for a natural thyroid hormone such as Armour or synthetic such as levothyroxine. If your case is subclinical, there are herbs and amino acids to help, like tyrosine and iodine, kelp and bladderwrack, rhodiola, selenium, zinc, ashwagandha, and coleus are all supportive to the thyroid. But in that situation as well, we might also check to see if somebody has an environmental toxicity burden that's contributing to their thyroid dysfunction. And even if you're hypothyroid to the point where you're never going to get off thyroid medicine, if you detoxify and say you have some heavy metal burden and you detoxify and you help get rid of that heavy metal burden, and that's something I can talk about at another time, you may be able to lower the amount of thyroid medicine that you take because your thyroid will be functioning better. If you don't have a thyroid gland, you have to take thyroid hormone. But if your thyroid is really, really not functioning, or you had most of your thyroid removed, then you may have to take some thyroid supplementation. But if you have, you know, when you're off, your TSH is around 3 or 4. And when you take your medicine, you can get your TSH down to 2, 1 or 2. It is possible that you have a toxic burden that if you address that, you may be able to take less medicine, or sometimes even, I can't promise this, but sometimes even get off your medicine. So iron, we need to make sure that you're not anemic or iron deficient. So if you are, we'd offer you a non-constipating iron, such as a chelated iron or iron bisglycinate. We don't tend to offer you iron sulfate because iron sulfate tends to make you constipated. So if you're bleeding a lot, you can become iron deficient. So if you're bleeding a lot and you're very tired, let your practitioner check you to see if you're anemic or iron deficient or both. And then we're going to help you with that. So if we want to help somebody build up their blood because they're losing a lot of blood, we'll give them iron to take. And we'll also tend to make sure they're eating a lot of leafy greens. And if for whatever reason they can't manage to eat a lot of leafy greens, we might give them some kind of a green supplement. So that's helpful for people. So that's a lot of good information about dysfunctional uterine bleeding. So next week I'll probably talk about some of the things I learned at the NHAND conference, which will be very interesting. So wherever you're at, take a deep breath. Hope you can be calmer. Get outside. We've been having some unusually warm weather for November, and it's been gorgeous outside. So go outside and get some sunshine while it's happening, because at some point the weather's going to flip and it's going to get cold again. So enjoy yourself out there while you can. And wherever you're at with the election, hopefully you can find some way towards peace and connection with your fellow humans and fellow Americans. So I'm going to go now. All right. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am France Dorch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Maniza. Hey. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at France Dorch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the the staff, management, or licensee of this station. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS stores, and WHUS.org.